From runasradio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the weekly internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell and Greg Hughes. This is Carl Franklin announcing show number one with guest Patrick Hines, recorded April 6th, 2007. Run As Radio is produced each week by Pwop Productions, offering professional media and podcasting services. Online at pwop.com. Hello, this is Carl Franklin from .NET Rocks, and I'm here as a special guest for this introductory edition of Run As Radio. Richard Campbell, how are you, sir?
I am well, and thanks for doing this for us, Carl.
It's my pleasure. .NET Rocks has been a wildly successful Microsoft .NET developer show, 220-some-odd shows in the can so far, and we decided to do a Microsoft IT-focused show in which Richard Campbell is going to play the host.
Yeah, because I'm kind of a mutant creature having a foot in both camps, you know, not only wrote the software for the machine, but I built the machine from scratch.
Right.
So it was a logical fit for me. I usually am more focused on issues around how gear works and so on. In my career, I've spent a lot of time building out data centers and dealing with making infrastructure work as well as how the software worked.
Needless to say, you're qualified for the job. And Greg Hughes, how are you, sir?
I'm doing just fine. And how are you?
I'm fine. I'm well. You were a natural choice for the co-host, not only because of your association with Scott Hanselman, in which we're going to hear about in a second, but you are also a popular IT blogger who's Microsoft-centric.
Well, I do have a blog. It's over at greghughes.net, and I've been writing on that for a few years. My background, really, I also share Richard's interest and experience in doing a lot of infrastructure. Over the last few years, I've really migrated quite a bit toward the security side of things and security operations, and both on the IT and the process side.
And that's great. I can't wait to hear what you guys are going to do with the show, and I'm sure a lot of people are too, a lot of listeners. There's quite a lot of untapped potential here, because there aren't a lot of Microsoft-centric IT shows out there, are there?
I'm surprised at the diversity of topics. You know, we have a good time on .NET Rocks with all the things we talk about around software development. But when you start thinking about what IT professionals need to be concerned with, it's vast. I mean, I'm really glad Greg's with us, because he's a security guy, and that's always high on the list. But data storage, mail services, networking in general, issues around regulatory compliance.
Yeah,
I think these are all things that IT guys worry about, and we're going to go out and round up the best and brightest and try and get some answers.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right, and we have some real exciting topics on the plate, and I think it's going to be a lot of fun. And this will be somewhat unique, I think, having the Microsoft focus, but also I'm just really excited about the fact that we're going to be putting together some really interesting conversations.
And this show is typically going to be about a half an hour, but we ran a little bit long this time because of this introduction and of course the talk with Pat Hines, which is coming up. But we typically want to run this at about a half an hour. Is that right, guys?
My real vision is that we have a single topic each show, and that will tend to run shorter. I mean, experience with .NET Rocks has found that typically we talk about a few different things along the way, whichever way the conversation goes. And I really want to try and focus on an individual thing. We'll see what happens. If it works to go longer, I'll go longer. I hope the listeners will let us know what they like.
Okay, and of course, you can send us your feedback and get all sorts of information about the show at www.runasradio.com. And guys, this is where I step off. You have a good show.
Thanks very much, Carl. All right, Greg, let's introduce our guest. Patrick Hines is the president of Critical Sites and a Microsoft regional director. named by Microsoft as regional director for Boston, he has been recognized as a leader in the technology fields, an expert on Microsoft technology, and experience with other technologies as well, WebSphere, Sybase, storage management, Java, Unix, NetWare, and network security. Patrick has taught freelance software development and network architecture and has been a successful consultant who has enjoyed mastering difficult troubleshooting assignments. A graduate of West Point and a Gulf War veteran, Patrick brings an uncommon level of dedication to his leadership role at critical sites. Experienced in addressing business challenges with a special emphasis on security issues involving leading-edge database, storage, web, and hardware systems, Patrick often speaks at major technical conferences, including TechEd US, TechEd Hong Kong, and the Middle East Developers Conference in Cairo, Egypt, the Microsoft Security Summit in New York and Boston, Dev Days, Code Camp, and many more. In spite of the demands of his management role at critical sites, Patrick stays technical and in the trenches, acting as project manager and or developer or engineer on selected projects throughout the year. Welcome, Patrick.
Thank you.
So what is it you don't do?
Windows.
Ah, there you go.
Actually, that's not true. I do Windows.
So we've talked many times. I mean, Pat, you and I have been at conferences and so forth together.
Yep, just recently.
Today, though, I really wanted to talk about storage technology, something you and I have chatted about over dinner once or twice. Mm-hmm. So what area, well, maybe we should sort of back off and say, what do we mean by storage technologies?
Well, so when you say storage technologies, it evokes to me, where am I going to put my bits? Where am I throwing the data that I care about? And one of the things that I think we should start with is, how do you think about that? How do you think about storage? Is it just a disk? Is it just a product that you buy? Or is it a service that you have to provide to whatever community, developer community, user community, knowledge worker, customer community?
Does it really get into something that ultimately I'm selling to my customer?
It depends on who you are. I mean, if you're running the, if you're storage manager at Fortune 100 company or Global 1000 company, you're trying to just stay ahead of demand. Right now we're seeing, we're still on the cusp of people seeing 100% storage growth per year. We were talking to a large financial organization over in London earlier this year, who said that they started off this year at 700 terabytes and they'll be over 1.5 petabytes by the end of the year.
Those are big numbers.
Yes, they're very big numbers. And they're scary numbers, because how do you back up to tape a petabyte? You don't, is really the answer. And so there's a lot of things that, a lot of paradigms are breaking and shattering now under the just sheer weight of the growth.
I wonder how many times we've actually been successful at using tape backup in a disaster recovery scenario ever.
Oh, I've seen many, many more stories where it's failed than where it's succeeded. And most companies are realizing that. The vast majority of companies I talk to are going to disk to disk, and they're doing replication between sites and things of that nature. But that increases the amount of disk you have, because now you have double the disk, or triple sometimes.
Not to mention the network connectivity and all the different infrastructure that has to be in place to be able to support that.
Exactly. And bandwidth has always been the most expensive resource after manual labor. And so if I need to double the disk on a project, let's say I have an office in Memphis, and I come to you and say, look, the project's going, I need to double the disk. Most people will just say, no problem. It doesn't matter what the disk is. If it's 50 terabytes, 100 terabytes, double the disk is not an interesting number. The maintenance of it is, but most people don't think in those terms. But if I said I had to double the bandwidth to that office, it's probably going to go all the way up to the CTO level and the CIO level to get approval, because bandwidth is so expensive.
And you couple bandwidth into storage technologies. Or more, let me rephrase that. You couple backup into storage technologies.
Well, you have to. I mean, I can give you a free puppy. Does that mean the puppy's free?
Tell that to a Linux guy.
Well, so the cost of having something, especially, that's where the whole definition of whether it's a product or a service comes in. If it's a product, then the cost of it is the cost of it. If I buy a pen, the cost of the pen is what it is. I don't have to maintain the pen. I don't have to keep the pen online. When the pen's done, I throw it away. I've never seen that happen with an online storage solution. Whatever data is on that storage is got to be supported. Put a terabyte up. Let the users use it for a year. Try to take it offline.
Yeah.
God help you.
As soon as you provide a service, it's a one-way trip.
Right. You will, if it's not the same terabyte, you'll be replacing it and migrating that data for the rest of eternity.
All right. So let's talk about technologies then. What are the options?
Well, there's still stone tablets. the big three are SAN, regular server storage, which is really falling out of favor just because of limitations in size and flexibility, and NAS. Those are the buckets. You either have a big server with a big disk, you have a number of servers with a SAN, you know, with the, which they're front-ending for, or you've got NAS devices that act as storage points throughout the enterprise.
I think for the purpose of people that maybe aren't familiar with the terms, you want to explain a storage area network or what the different terms mean?
Sure. So we refer to the first one, just a server with storage, as direct attached storage. This is where the storage is attached to the bus of the box. Think any RAID flavor you've ever considered. That's what everybody's used to because that's what you buy. A SAN is a much more expensive and much more flexible mechanism where you have a big honking disk. That's a technical term. Big honking disk. Yeah. A big monster fast disk that sits out there and allows LUNs, logical unit numbers, to be split off and shared and allocated. So let's say I have a SAN that's a petabyte, or make it easy, 100 terabyte SAN. I may have server one that gets 15 terabytes, server two that gets 25, server three that gets 50, and I hold some more in reserve. So each of those chunks or those logical unit numbers or LUNs can be assigned to a server and act as if it's a local drive to the server. But the speeds can be much faster because they're typically fiber channel connected historically, although TCP/IP, iSCSI has become more popular. So this is where you still connect to the server, you still connect to a share in the server, but the disk is actually somewhere else. It's abstracted. Typically, SAN is more expensive, and it was the first off-the-box solution. SAN was the thing that came out, and big companies started doing it. Large banks, think of the top five banks, they were probably the first ones to go down this road. Then NAS, Network Attached Storage, is where you get a better model as far as cost goes. With NAS, the biggest competitors would be Windows-based NASs. EMC is pretty big in that space. You can buy an EMC NAS through Dell. But the two big competitors would be EMC with their Solera and Network Appliance with their Filer, and also IBM, which just came out with their own Filer. And so what those are boxes with disk and their own operating system and their own ability to share. And so it's like a network printer. The printer doesn't have to be connected to a server to do its thing and for you to connect to it. The disk is the same way. It's out on the network. It has its own address. It has its own resolution. It has its own tools. NAS is typically much cheaper, byte for byte than SAN. And it's much more flexible and performant than server-based storage. So those are the three choices, and most of the big customers I talk to have all three.
Does iSCSI sort of blur the line? I mean, I've always seen iSCSI as a SAN technology, yet it seems to act very NAS-like.
Everybody's trying to figure out how to use it. Everybody's advertising it. It's really about, you know, how's your infrastructure? Do you want fiber channel, which is difficult, and what if I want to throw fiber channel between two buildings? Now I'm talking about very specialized technology. Or can I just use a gigabit Ethernet or 10 gigabit Ethernet to bridge those two gaps?
So in your mind, all iSCSI really is direct connect Cat5 gigabit Ethernet between the devices.
Well, so it's got some, it's evolved beyond that. It's got some other features and some other capabilities that make it more competitive with fiber channel. But easier to implement, cheaper to implement, and eventually higher bandwidth than fiber channel. The problem with fiber channel is it's wicked high bandwidth, but it's not evolving nearly as fast as the iSCSI is.
It seems like fiber in general has hit a wall here in terms of utilization.
Yeah, because again, it's glass. Everybody, it's very difficult to work with. It's brittle. It's just got too many. It's the first generation of the technology.
And it's never really evolved.
Yeah. It's, you know, the odds that they'd get it right on the first try are zero.
having implemented NAS, SAN, a few different SANs, and an awful lot of local attached storage or server direct attached, I can echo the fact that the cost between these is pretty exorbitantly different.
Yeah.
Maybe you could talk a little bit about how extreme those cost differences really are.
They're very different. It's like a Ferrari versus a good GM car, I guess, or maybe that's an oxymoron, depending on who you are.
Oh, goodness.
I know people don't like it, but to be honest with you, this I can get all the functionality I need out of a Jeep. I don't have to buy a Land Rover.
Right.
But a Land Rover is going to set me back a lot more. It's going to give me some flexibility. Maybe it's better for specifics. I kind of always thought about the SAN versus NAS as depends on what you're using it for and how you want to use it. For instance, we have a SAN here. We also have several NASs. The SAN is used for the primary storage for our servers, our Exchange server, our file servers have a large line, our backup servers. And we have all the disks centralized. We have access to it through management utilities. The users can map their home directories in the same way. It wasn't that big of a difference in price because we went with the EMC SAN. And through Dell, that's a much cheaper option. So the price difference is narrowing, but in the early days, it was the difference between buying IBM versus buying Novell. If you remember those days, you bought IBM Token Ring because that's what everybody bought.
Right.
But you could buy a Novell network, and it was, you could do it a lot cheaper, and it even had some advantages.
Well, you had, and networking worked.
Yeah.
So, I mean, your point is NAS works and has always worked. SAN was sort of the deluxe solution.
Yeah.
I used to see that SAN was the larger solution. When you were talking petabytes, weren't you always talking SAN?
And to some extent, you still are, although that's changing now. The thing about SAN is it's a more mature technology. It's actually been around longer. NAS was a reaction of, wow, these SANs are a great idea. How can we make this cheaper?
Makes sense.
Yeah. And network appliance is probably the big innovator here. EMC is a force, but they're still got such a wide product line, whereas NetApp is actually more focused just on the NAS version. So they don't have all the other software, all the other sub companies. EMC bought Veritas, so they have a bunch of solutions from them as well. So I watch them quite a bit to see where the innovation is coming from. But again, EMC is a big company, and they're doing a lot too.
You know, one of the things that crosses my mind, the questions that comes up for me, I'd be interested to hear your thought on, is we're seeing a lot more, we've talked about backup versus storage and really how that's a very much a blurred line now. We're seeing a lot of like home backup systems, a lot of services that are out there. Microsoft has in beta their home server, and there's a lot of ASP or service type of offerings out there. What's your thought about that, and maybe do you have any thoughts about the future?
Yeah, I think it's a great phenomenon. I like the idea that people are looking to back up their stuff, because up till now, the answer's almost always been, oh, your stuff's gone? Yeah, it's too bad it's gone. Almost every time somebody came to me with a burned out computer or something, there was no backups. A lot of these backups are the one touch backups. So you plug the 300 gigabyte device in, you hit a button, and it just goes and grabs everything it can from the server that's connected to and just copies it.
Right.
I haven't played with them because I've got a more mature backup solution at home, disk to disk to one remote building to the other. But I think it's a good thing. I think it's the logical place for that market to go to. And I like the fact that it skipped tape. It just went right to disk.
Sure. You know, I think having worked with all these technologies and sort of being in the online banking industry, I see SAN as being, you mentioned, the more mature model. It's been around longer. It also has some feature functionality that can be really very robust if you need to be able to, for example, synchronize LUNs and drive arrays, or if you need to be able to do splits so that you can take one off, make a copy and take it offline, then you can do your backup or do some other form of protection. Where do you see the NAS world hasn't quite caught up there yet? Is what's happening technology wise in the NAS world to bring it really on par with with SAN, not just from a bandwidth perspective, but from a feature functionality perspective?
So the thing is, you're right in all points, and what you might not be paying as much attention to as I am, because I do actually go and speak at some of the storage conferences, is the NAS people have a Napoleonic complex against SAN. they really want to beat them. And what they're doing is they're adding in functionality much faster than most people realize. For instance, let's say I have a 3050 filer.
And this is a NetApp?
This is a NetApp filer. It's dual, you know, it's a cluster. It's two heads and a humongous number of drives. And the way you normally set it up is you take half the drives and allocate them to one head, and the half of the drives allocate them to the other head. And what they've done is, if the drives don't fail, because the drives typically don't fail, and if they do, they're all rated on the shelf, and therefore there's a swap out. But if the drives don't fail, but one of the heads fails, they're set up to assume the identity of each other. So this is a really nice fault-tolerant feature. So I'm on the network. I've got my two NAS heads on the same switch. If one of the brains cooks off and dies, the other one detects that the heartbeat is gone, and it assumes the identity and manages the disk it used to manage and answers any calls to its dead brother.
Sounds an awful lot like active-active clustering in something like SQL Server.
Right. And so SQL is actually something that's a big deal now on NAS, as is Exchange, as is Oracle. So it's becoming an application platform in a way that SAN has traditionally been the application platform.
Right. So this is similar to the redundant HBAs or host bus adapters on a SAN.
Yes, but at a lower cost, because I get to actually, I'm not just paying for the redundancy, I actually get to use the object and use it as a backup. And we're starting to talk about much higher, as I said earlier, much higher numbers of terabytes. We're in the petabyte range now with some of the NASs, which just wasn't heard of before.
That used to be SAN country only.
Exactly.
Yeah. One of the topics of discussion that that's sort of tracked over time has to do with density of storage, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of us know sort of what a standard data center rack looks like.
Yeah.
And quite often, you know, you'll see SANs, for example, taking up a single rack. What's density looking like now, and what are they doing in the NAS space, and how much storage can you fit into some given area?
So I that's an interesting question, and I haven't really thought it out recently. If I had to swag it, I'd say you could probably fit a petabyte in two or three racks.
Now, are we still talking about SCSI only for the drives in any of these density storage solutions? It's still, we're stuck at 147 gigabyte SCSI drives?
Well, getting beyond that, we're seeing 340s and three, I don't know what the exact multiples are, but we're seeing bigger drives, which is why we can see a petabyte in less than a data center.
And in all cases, it's not always SCSI anymore either. Is that right? We're seeing other technologies that are maybe a little more commonplace in what you might think of as being, term would be a commodity type of drive.
Right. Yeah, because they want to lower the price of the disks. Because, I mean, mean time between failures, if mean time between failures is 300,000 hours, that's a long time, especially when you can afford to lose a disk and still work.
Because you're running in some kind of redundant array.
Right.
That tolerates this.
Right. And now there's dual parity, so you can lose two disks.
Right.
So, I mean, we're getting to the point where I'd actually want my cardiac care unit running on these storage devices as opposed to being horrified by the idea that a PC might control my heart rate.
You know, one of the unfortunate facts of the world, even today, is that there's still an awful lot of places that are running mission critical applications on a machine that's been sitting under somebody's desk for a few years.
Yeah.
The beauty of centralized storage and being able to connect to that as you become independent of that machine, but also you become much more reliable.
True. And what we alluded to before is the disaster recovery scenarios after 9/11 have become much more sophisticated. Disk to disk over long distances is a much more interesting thing now, because people see you actually have to recover.
So two different backup scenarios. Is the local backup scenario essentially dead? This array dies, I need another one here to switch over to, just because that array is redundant enough now, it's just not going to fail?
No, it depends on your data. So I was actually working on a white paper, and I haven't written it yet, about data classification for exactly what you're talking about. So let's take an example, my organization. We do software development. We have some commercial products that we're about to release in the security space, and we've got a sister company that's historically been an ISV. So when I look at backups for our organization, all things are not created equal. Think about encryption. If I want to encrypt, you know, the secrets to the nuclear arsenal, I want that encryption to stand the test of time. I don't want you to hack it. You can hack it for 3 years, and I don't want you to break it.
Right.
But if I'm firing artillery, and I'm going to transmit the coordinates that I'm going to hit in 40 seconds, I can use much weaker encryption.
Yes, because the data is not meaningful a minute later.
Right. Hope, you know, anybody who would care about it is gone by the time they could break the code. If we do it right.
Spoken so, like a West Pointer.
Yeah, I got to get those military analogies in.
There you go.
The same is true with data. All data is not created equal. And classification is the missing component. There's a bunch of people out there claiming to do classification, and almost no one does. So let's take a look at my organization. I got a visual source safe repository.
Right, that's source code place.
Critical. I got Exchange, critical. I've got a financial package, you know, invoicing, POs, all that, critical. Customer database, CRM, critical. Home directories, important, but not, I'm not going to die if they don't come back. Websites, I'd be annoyed if I had to recreate them, but technically, they should be in my source safe, shouldn't they?
Right.
How about, you know, my copies of my CDs that we posted into a directory so we can install from them? That's not even worth backing up. So there's categories of stuff that I can't live without, stuff that, you know, I would be annoyed or impaired if it was gone, but the world would go on. There's stuff that I would probably actually be better off if it went away. Have you ever had a PC die, lose all the data, and be relieved?
Oh, absolutely.
Because you knew that there was just so much muck on it that the little good stuff you lost is worth the sacrifice.
That ultimately the cleanup cost, if that machine hadn't died, is higher than the value we would have gotten back from it.
Exactly.
How cynical is that?
It's realistic, though. So I don't think that. I think the local backup is still viable. For instance, we have several sites. We have offices overseas as well as here in the U.S., and we're just opening an office. I'm in New Hampshire right now. We're opening an office in Massachusetts, and we're going to be replicating our data, our mission-critical data, between those two sites. So we do a backup here, and then we copy that backup over VPN to that other location. And so that way, if a tactical nuke goes off here, we've got the fallback plan.
Let's go with just a site catastrophic event.
So we're right next to an airport, so we keep thinking about the plane that's going to hit the building. So that does that qualify?
Yeah, but it could also be a hurricane. I mean, I like site catastrophic event because just like the site's going to go down. I've dealt with, you know, places in hurricane space.
Yep.
Think about the plan you want to have when you're in New Orleans and a Katrina is coming.
Yeah.
So there, now we're talking about an offsite backup solution.
For the things that you care about.
Right.
Again, there's things that you probably won't, even if you had extra time and money, you wouldn't spend it on getting that stuff over. Because it just doesn't matter. Your license, I mean, maybe I install Office from a share on the network. It's data on the network. Do I need to back it up? No, I've got it on DVD.
One of the interesting things that you mentioned, when you were using your analogy related to 45 seconds, then the coordinates that I'm sitting at for the mortar round doesn't
Yep.
apply anymore. Another kind of an interesting time-based data backup or movement of data and where do you store and when do you backup question comes into play. And I think we're seeing more and more of this now related to what information is it that I touch on a regular basis on my network versus what information is it that's just sitting there but nobody has touched in quite a period of time.
Right.
And what's the value of the data based on that and how available does it need to be? I think a lot of the backup question now isn't just do I have a copy of it, but what form of availability do I have? Where is technology going, or what's the current story with in relation to that?
So, again, it comes down to the classification, because most organizations don't have as clear a handle on what data matters to them as an organization the size of ours. I know crystal clear what data matters and what data doesn't to within a certain extent, and so it becomes challenging. And hopefully I'm not going off topic, but have you heard about what happened to Merrill about last year? They were given a court order to produce some data that they had that was on their network, but they couldn't find it.
Absolutely.
And they paid a $10 million fine for not producing data they actually had.
Wow, nice cost of operations there.
Right. So it's the problem is, if you talk to Gartner, I don't know what their exact numbers are, but I think it's 20 to 40 or 45% of everything on the average network. This isn't the worst run networks in the world. The average network is junk. It's stuff that just shouldn't be there. It's either no longer valid or it was never valid. And the big problem that people are fighting beyond recovery is are we recovering the junk along with the good stuff?
And consequently, are we backing up the junk along with the good stuff?
Here's a scary statistic, I'll just ask you the question. You may guess correctly, but most people don't. What's the size of a 1 hour uncompressed HD video, roughly?
An uncompressed HD video? I don't know. I mean, even MPEG-2, that's about 2 gigabytes.
Yeah, this is half a terabyte.
Half a terabyte.
Yeah. So if I tape 1 hour of, March Madness in HD to my 1 terabyte USB drive that I got for Christmas, and I don't think about it, and I copy it down to the drive overnight, and I come into the office, and I plug it in, and I decide to throw it up on the server to share with Bill, and I copy it, while I'm out during the day, and I don't even pay attention to the size, I could eat a terabyte or more. Football game is going to be a full terabyte.
Right.
And in an unintelligent backup system, then you're backing up half a terabyte worth of HD video.
Right. And it's probably worse than that, because maybe I might even crash the server by consuming all the disk space.
Yeah, you've found a pretty extreme example, but it's true that these things happen. This is how we end up with getting 2 megabyte photographs from our friends, because they just don't know about JPEG.
I mean, I've seen the results of an employee at a client who was terminated for cause, and then they find out that their entire home directory is a terabyte of YouTube videos.
Right.
Because they have no controls. I mean, policies are really the key here. If you know what goes into the disks in the right location, then you can control that. Then the users can't get off the reservation, if you will. For instance, who was it we were working with? Merrill. It was Merrill Lynch. They had a problem where they had PST files,
Outlook data files,
and in home directories. Now, you wouldn't think that's a problem, but they had incremental backups. Well, one thing about PSTs is if Outlook connects to a PST, even if you never read anything out of it and you never write anything to it, it modifies the date and the archive bit of the PST, which means all the PSTs in the organization were getting picked up on incremental backup, and the incremental backups were terabytes in size.
Of course they were. And you don't actually get an incremental backup of a PST. You get a whole backup of a PST.
Exactly. So, well, they were hoping to just capture the PSTs that had actually been modified, but they were getting the ones that were just connected to, and
right,
most of them were connected to automatically. So they used our sister company's product, AntiB Software QFS, to set a policy that said, you can't put PSTs in your home directory. They go in your PST directory. And so they completely eliminated the problem and did some other policies about MP3s can't go on this disk and you can't put any video content here. And that's the next generation. The next generation is to actually control what you can do with the storage, not whether you have access to it or not.
Provisioning is just not enough. If I limited you to 100 gigabytes of personal storage on the network, you wouldn't have written your March Madness file out to me. But that's not necessarily a good enough solution.
Well, because I would have written out 100, 100 gigabytes?
Yeah.
You would have given me 100 gigabytes of family photos and wedding invitations and MP3 files and bootleg copies of Shrek and everything else.
Typically followed by a request for additional storage because I've run out of space.
Right.
Exactly.
Right.
Merck is another one. So I should clarify this. NTP Software is a sister company for Critical Sites. They're our biggest customer, and I do work with them quite a bit. So I'm intimately involved with their products. NTP Software does a lot of software related to this specific problem, policy-based management, storage firewalling, basically. And Merck had a situation where they wanted a lights-out strategy. They wanted to set limits on users, but they didn't want to have the IT group managing increases to those limits because, you know, users use up the space they're allocated, and if they reasonably can use more and there's a business use, you want their manager to approve it, not go through the storage guy. So we implemented what's called self-managing storage, where the user can request, when they hit a limit, they can go through a website and make a request for more storage. But part of the request is an analysis of what they're using the storage for. And the manager gets an email that says, this user wants an increase in storage. This is how much they're using. This is what they're using it for. And the manager can look and say, they have a gigabyte of MP3 files. Send a message to the user, get rid of the MP3 files, denied. Okay, so there's a lot, these kinds of getting the user out of the business of competing with storage is really the next big push. Trying to get the user to be part of the solution as opposed to part of the problem is the real big push. I mean, I kind of dragged us here from backup, but backups have traditionally been the problem because we're backing up too much junk. If we can increase the quality, get the signal to noise ratio to a logical place, then that's the big win in storage management.
All right. We've danced around offsite solutions. What methods have you used, Pat, to make offsite work for you?
So I'm a low tech guy sometimes. I know that doesn't show, but I kind of like the idea of doing the backups local and then piping them based on, you know, available bandwidth or when you have the time offsite. There are solutions where it's a bit's written here and a bit's transmitted over the WAN and written in Chicago at the same instant. And those are organizations that are spending $100 million plus on storage management a year.
And
right.
Usually you hear the term replication associated with that.
Yeah. They have more bandwidth than most small suburbs between their sites. We've dealt with those companies. In fact, there's a couple of companies that we helped recover from 9/11 in New York, that was their strategy. And that's one of the reasons that they were back up in hours. We had one financial institution we worked with, and I can't name names here, that we had them back up, through a lot of help of their own, in 4 hours, and another one in 8. And the difference really was just about process and procedures, but they were using mostly the same technology.
Anything under a day, and you had a pretty good plan.
Yeah.
That's redundant gear, a separate copy of everything. Like, you don't have time to configure much of anything to get back up in a day.
And one of the interesting things about, you know, where the world is now and where technology is moving right now is, you know, if you're over a day, there's a good chance that you're flying tapes somewhere and actually bringing something up. You start to get into the hours and you're talking about, you know, occasional replication. We even have companies now that are literally live in more than one location doing truly distributed applications and storage. And you're talking a matter of seconds to a matter of minutes to be able to be fully synchronized and fully online. And the loss of one site is really something that is almost a non-event from a production standpoint.
Yeah. Well, when we do security audits, there's a definite break in the character of the conversation. We do a lot of security audits here at Critical Sites, and I have a conversation with typically senior management, sometimes the owners, depending on how big the company is, and the conversation is always kind of touchy, and that is, okay, you lose this site, it's completely wiped out. You've got a disaster recovery plan. This is what you're going to do. We've already talked about this. We reviewed this. What if all the people are gone too? What if 95% of the staff doesn't survive or is not available anymore? Do you continue on? In a company with under 1,000 people, the answer is typically no.
Interesting truth. I'm just thinking about this idea of active redundancy of data centers, that you have two different data centers that are doing similar work in different areas and are the failover site for each other.
Kind of like what NetApp does.
Yeah, it's the same scenario, or what you do in SQL Server and so forth. I mean, if being able to recover quickly is the critical feature, then the answer is two data centers that you're using routinely.
Yeah, it's a tough sell, though, because the Fortune 1000, and even some of them not so much, are hard to convince because this is for something that might never happen.
Right. Yeah, I think it only makes sense if you can actually make that other data center do valuable work.
Right.
On its own, you know, and actually split the load between the data centers. I've certainly run into the issue with my customers where we just couldn't get more space in this data center, so we went somewhere else because we needed the space. Mm-hmm. And ended up with this advantage of having a failover solution.
It's funny you mentioned space, because the other factor that I'm seeing more and more is companies saying, I'm in central London, I've got a data center, and I can't put one more watt or get one more bit of AC into this data center unless I get something out.
Because the power is just not available. It's not always the floor space. Quite often, it's the power.
It's electricity. Right. Yeah, it's surprising how much that comes up.
And the HVAC to get rid of it.
And I was doing the numbers while you were talking about how much space a petabyte takes up. And if you're using 500 gig drives at high density, 13 drives per 3 U's on a 48U, you're still talking about a dozen full racks.
Really?
Yeah. Maybe I'm doing my math wrong.
No, you might be right. A dozen full racks.
Well, if you think about what it would have taken to rack a petabyte 5 years ago, yeah. A dozen racks is nothing.
No, I guess I must have been thinking about 100 gigs, 100 terabytes then.
Yeah, a petabyte is just an awful lot of space. And irrespective of the fact of the cost of all of those racks, you get immediately into how much electricity, how much HVAC for that storage.
What I really like is the metric of how big is a petabyte? Well, 5 petabytes, I'm told, depends on how you do your estimates. But if you took every word ever spoken by every human who's ever lived, including these, and turn them into plain text, they'd fit on 5 petabytes.
Yeah, I'd buy that.
Or every item ever sold on eBay.
Whichever comes first.
We're well into this idea now of what is valuably stored. Like, you can gather a tremendous amount of data about your systems and about your customers and how much of it is truly valuable.
I think also there's the question of what is valuably stored where. I'm kind of going earlier, you know, if there's files that I maybe need to be able to have access to, but I don't touch them, nobody has touched them in the last 2 years, then what level of access to those files do I need, and what's the cost of the storage where I'm putting those?
Yeah, hierarchical storage management is another of those, I wish we could do that, and no one's really, I can't say no one's doing it, but the problem is, how do you do it? And how do you classify? If you can't classify, it's tough to know what and what not to move.
Sure.
I mean, ideally, you have your primary storage, which is expensive. You have your secondary storage, which you only move the stuff that you will need. So, let's say half of the stuff never makes it to secondary storage. And then you have tertiary storage, which is the archive, the record books. And hopefully that's less than 20% of the size of your original storage. But then it accumulates.
So ultimately it ought to be bigger.
Eventually, yeah. But again, you have to understand your data and classify it correctly. And it's something no one's got a handle on.
I see a theme here, Pat, that the real challenge of good storage management is effective classification of data.
Yeah. Well, you do it in your home life every day. You know the difference between good furniture and junk. You know what goes in the garage versus what goes in the attic versus what goes in the yard for the burn pile.
Right. Yeah, the cutlery in the drawer, the cutlery in the china cabinet, and the cutlery in the attic.
And in the safe deposit box.
Right.
But if you take all the cutlery and throw it all in one drawer and just keep tossing stuff in there, then ultimately you're going to understand and you may have an idea of what's out on the surface, but what lies underneath is something that is no longer very apparent.
Which is how everybody lives right now.
Yeah, data-wise.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen the sitcoms where you walk into the apartment, typically Friends, I think, and the place is just, it looks like a bomb went off. and you couldn't find anything in that room if you tried. Well, that's how we live in our storage world every day. Most corporations couldn't lay their hands on anything that they haven't used recently to save their life.
Literally to the tune of $10 million.
Exactly.
Yeah, there's an old adage, you know, if only we knew what we know, then everything would be fine.
Right.
So, yep. You know, that corpus of knowledge, what, you know, at a corporation or a company or an organization, and the insight into that is still, and this has been, you know, it's been adage that's been used for the last 10 years, but even still today, to really be able to have deep insight into that aggregated knowledge, which is, of course, taking up storage, is something that's still quite a challenge.
Yeah.
Pat, thanks so much. Really enjoyed talking to you.
Thanks for having me.
And we'll see you next week on Run As Radio.